Safety in Chatham.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. After days of wrangling and delay, this morning, the White House released its strongest evidence yet against Osama bin Laden. The videotape shows bin Laden meeting in Kandahar with a visiting Saudi sheikh and members of the Al-Qaeda network in early November. Officials say it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that bin Laden is the mastermind behind the September 11th attacks. We begin with excerpts from the tape as translated for the U.S. government by four Arab language experts and read here by WBUR's Ahmed Ahmed.
We calculated in advance the number of casualties from the enemy who would be killed based on the position of the tower. We calculated that the floors that would be hit would be three or four floors. I was the most optimistic of them all. During my experience in this field, I was thinking that the fire from the gas in the plane would melt the iron structure of the building and collapse the area where the plane hit and all the floors above it only. This is all that we had hoped for. Abul Hassan al-Masri, who appeared on Al Jazeera TV a couple of days ago and addressed the Americans saying, "If you're a true man, come down here and face us." He told me a year ago, "I saw in a dream we were playing a soccer game against the Americans. When our team showed up in the field, they were all pilots." He said, "So I wondered if that was a soccer game or a pilot game. Our players were pilots." He didn't know anything about the operation until he heard it on the radio. He said the game went on and we defeated them. That was a good omen for us. The brothers who conducted the operation, all they knew was that they have a martyrdom operation, and we asked each of them to go to America, but they didn't know anything about the operation, not even one letter. But they were trained, and we didn't reveal the operation to them until they are there and just before they boarded the planes. They were overjoyed when the first plane hit the building, so I said to them, "Be patient." I witnessed that against the sharp blade, they always faced difficulties and stood together. When the darkness comes upon us and we are bit by a sharp tooth, I say, "Our homes are flooded with blood and the tyrant is freely wandering in our homes." And from the battlefield vanished the brightness of the swords and the horses. An overweeping sounds now. We hear the beats of drums and rhythm. They are storming his forts and shouting, "We will not stop our raids until you free our lands."
Excerpts from the videotape of Osama bin Laden, ending with bin Laden reciting poetry, read by WBUR's Ahmed Ahmed. This hour, we're getting reaction to the tape from across the spectrum. First, from inside the Beltway, I spoke with Senator Joe Biden, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I asked him when he first found out about the videotape and whether or not he thought it should be released.
Number one, I became aware of it about a week ago. I don't remember exactly, Tom. Number two, I think the way it's been, I think it should have been released. I indicated when asked by folks in the administration that I thought it should be released pending, without my having seen the quality of it. If it was of quality, it should be released. Having seen it now, the quality exceeds what I expected. And I think it is profound. I think it will have a profound impact. There are over a billion Muslims in the world, not just in the Arab world. I think this is compelling evidence of his complicity, but also his cynicism. I think the thing that may resonate more than even his calculation as to his expectation of how many Americans would be killed is his recognition and acknowledgement that some of the young soldiers for Allah went to their death without knowing it. They didn't sign on to that. And it's almost, you can almost, without knowing the language, you can almost detect the cynicism in his body language and the intonation. And so I think it's pretty pretty darn devastating. I think it's the first piece of genuine public diplomacy in the Muslim world that may have resonance.
Do you think it's still Osama bin Laden, and he still has that kind of weird charisma, even as he's talking about destroying?
No, he does.
Do you think there's any way it could be, even now, a kind of recruiting tape?
Well, I think with some wackos, yes. But I operate in the premise that the vast majority of the people in the Muslim world, the vast majority are rational people who have not been had sufficient information about U.S. intentions. And so this really goes to whether or not our intentions are against Islam or this guy. Now, I think the very serenity and almost cynicism that he expresses relative to his brothers has, for those who are on the ragged edge anyway, a charismatic quality. Do I agree with you? But in terms of the on balance, the impact is, I think, overwhelmingly positive for U.S. relations in the Arabic as well as the general Muslim world.
It's a remarkably intimate record of that time
with his
friends.
I mean, that gives it even a greater bit of profundity to it. I mean, there's this, it's like, wow, this is not like him standing at a podium making a speech. This is like he's with his good friends.
What details struck you?
The detail that struck me was how intimate the conversation was in terms of the circumstance. And the detail that struck me, there are two pieces of detail. One, him very clearly stating that he never anticipated that it would bring down the buildings, which is a very good thing to be said, because one of my worries from the 11th on, and I've been saying every show I've ever been on, is these guys exceeded their wildest expectations. They're not as good as they appeared to be. I don't want to make these guys 10 feet tall in terms of their capacity.
The superheroes.
The superheroes. That's number one. The second thing that struck me was the cynicism with which he was recounting how some of these hijackers had no notion that this was a suicide mission.
We know the tape has been the talk of Washington for several days now. Has it changed the mood there? Has it hardened it? If there was any room for it to harden?
Well, it hadn't hardened it. It's in a sense leavened it. In other words, there's been a sense of despair in some quarters about the ability to reach out to the bulk of the Muslim world, the so-called street, as we've all been referring to, the new news guys have been as well referring to it. We'll soon find out, because you all are going to be reporting today, tomorrow, the next day, as this is broadcast in other parts of the world, what the response is. But I'd be surprised if it does not inure to our benefit. Because when you have an undeclared war against a nation, there is, I think, an increased need for moral certitude. And this supplies that degree of moral certitude that we need. Because otherwise, one of the things we are subject to is not only a bit of envy in the world, but also a bit of the notion that they're so powerful, they're so big, they feel they can do anything anytime, and therefore, we immediately start off in some quarters of the world being discounted, our motives being discounted. You follow me?
Yes, I do.
And this speaks to that very clearly, and I think it's important.
And when and if Osama bin Laden is captured, do you think this tape will change the way he's treated by the U.S.? In what way?
Oh, I don't think how he's treated by the U.S. I think he is in for a rough ride being treated by the U.S. But I think it will change the way in which, if we capture him and if he is tried in the United States and not a military tribunal, or even in a military tribunal, I think it will change the attitude of the rest of the world about whether we're setting up a kangaroo court or whether or not we have a legitimate reason to convict him.
Senator Joe Biden, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, what feelings does this astonishing tape stir in you? Does the U.S.-led coalition now have the evidence and moral justification to do whatever it takes to take down Osama bin Laden? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Robert Kaplan joins us now. He's an author and journalist. His latest book is Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos. Thanks for joining us, Robert Kaplan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you back. You know the region well. You know the mindset, Robert Kaplan. What do you see in this tape?
All right. First of all, it's very interesting when he says that the terrorists carried out the law, the fikr, on September 11th, that they and they only interpreted the law well. What this means is that since the end of the Ottoman Empire in 1918 and the end of the Caliphate, there's been no official force to interpret Muslim doctrine in the modern age, so that anyone can interpret it any way they want. And because moderates have been opted out and they've kind of been coerced out of the debate, it's the law and its interpretation has been hijacked by extremists. So when he says a bunch of guys who hijacked a plane had the correct interpretation of the law, what that means is that, as Prince Hassan of Jordan told me, if moderates don't get into these discussions and arguments and fight for their interpretation of the law, mm-hmm. this kind of thing is going to continue. All right, the other thing is he's very concerned about his reputation in Saudi Arabia.
He's asking, in fact, about that, isn't he? Inquiring. How's it going down in the mosques?
So to a certain extent, as Joseph Conrad intimated, that every terrorist act has a long personal tragedy behind it.
Mm.
That obviously Osama bin Laden is a man who felt in many ways, kind of not well treated by his family, by his clan, whatever. He's showing that he's a big man, so to speak.
But isn't it also a political inquiry when he asks, what's the stand of the mosques? Doesn't he want to know, are people ready to stand up and join me, to follow me?
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. The other thing is that the very kind of, and Senator Biden said this, the very cynicism, the very coolness, the way he's talking about this.
Incredibly cool.
Yes. The Pentagon, any U.S. administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican, never says anything, never releases any information.
Mm-hmm.
That is not designed to advance the policy it's moving forward. And with the reason I think they released this tape was that anyone who even in the back of their mind had the slightest sympathy for this future defendant in a U.S. court, military or otherwise, is going to have even less now. Anyone overseas in foreign countries is going to have even less now.
Well, what about that, Robert Kaplan? Senator Biden says this is the persuasive evidence we needed for the Muslim world. You know how much anger is out there. Will people see through that anger to see this as clear evidence of bin Laden's complicity?
My interpretation of the Muslim world is that the people who are with bin Laden are going to be with him regardless of this tape. That to think that this tape is going to change the minds of people who are already committed is to take a very legalistic American interpretation of it. I think that the real benefit of this tape is that it makes it harder for regimes, for official leaders in the greater Middle East to claim that we don't have the proof. And it also makes it easier for European leaders to kind of take command of the debate with their leftists in their own country who are claiming that America doesn't have the evidence.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Kaplan, when you say this is a sign of bin Laden taking the law, Islamic law, into his own hands, making himself a kind of rebel caliph, but is it different from American Christian fundamentalists in the mountains in Montana saying that they know the one true way?
Yes, it's very different. Those people haven't killed 4,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't. They are not a threat to the government in Washington to the degree that that militant Islam is a threat to the regimes in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and other places.
And who do you think
we're a nation of institutions that
mm-hmm.
happen to have some extremists around the edges, but institutions are very weak and calcified mm-hmm. in the heartland of the Middle East.
Who do you think was the intended audience for this? It surely wasn't the Pentagon. Who did bin Laden want to eventually see this video?
That's a very good question. He may have wanted it to released around the mosques in Saudi Arabia and Egypt elsewhere. It doesn't appear from the tape that he foresaw the kind of very dynamic American military response that was to come.
And finally, do you think this could actually serve as a recruiting tape in the Middle East? Is there still some glamour around this guy, even as he admits these terrible acts?
Well, I think one thing about the Middle East is that anti-Americanism, anti-Western manifestations tend to go down when militant Islamists seem to be defeated. Because it's a part of the world where institutions are weak, it's very easy, people tend to be intimidated very easy by extremists. So when extremists are seen to be defeated militarily, momentarily their aura wears off.
Robert Kaplan, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Robert Kaplan is a journalist and author. His latest book is Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos. We're looking at those Bin Laden tapes. They're amazing. How does the tape look to you? What did it make you feel? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the tape of Osama bin Laden sitting perhaps in Kandahar, Afghanistan, with a couple of his associates and a visiting sheikh from Saudi Arabia, and talking with a kind of jovial luxury about the events of 9/11. They're rocking back and forth with satisfaction. They're savoring their good fortune. They're chuckling at the ignorance of the terrorists who went to the planes only at the last minute knowing what their mission would be. What do you make of those tapes? Are they convincing to you? Do you feel absolutely confident that they're authentic? And how do you think they'll go down in the Muslim world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Lawrence Korb. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He's now Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening, Lawrence Korb.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
When you see these tapes and you're following the arc of the war on terrorism, what does the release of the tapes mean to the war on terrorism to come out at this point? What do you think the impact will be?
Well, I think the impact is going to be very positive for the United States, because there were some countries who probably thought we didn't have any right to go after bin Laden, we didn't have real proof, and we couldn't release some of the information we had because we didn't want to compromise sources or methods. I think it will also discredit bin Laden among people in the Muslim world, many of whom do not particularly like the United States, but, you know, would not want to be part of such a horrendous act, particularly when he seemed to have misled some of the young men who got involved in this attack.
Lawrence Korb, when you watch the tape or what you've seen of it, just describe to us your visceral response or your first thoughts about the details there or the attitude of the men on the tape.
Well, I mean, one, after you get over the horror of the fact that they could laugh about something like this, you have to say that obviously they knew what they were doing. I mean, this was a well-conceived plan. Bin Laden at one point even talks about the fact that he understands something about construction. Remember, his father made his money in construction and, you know, understood what would happen with a plane crashing into the top of the World Trade Center and the damage it might do to the structure because of the, inflammable materials on there. The fact that the people in the groups didn't know each other, which meant it would be kind of difficult to compromise the operation. The fact that it had been planned. He said, you know, he knew the Thursday before, so he knew, you know, some 5 days before that this was actually going to go down.
Did it give you more or less respect for the organization of Al-Qaeda? I don't mean that in a moral sense, but just as a functioning, as an operational group.
Well, I think as an operational group, you have to admire their organization. In other words, this is not some pickup team that happened to get a lucky hit. This is a well-planned, well-executed, you know, operation by a group that is willing to go to extremes to get their point across.
And what do you think were the odds of a tape like this, so intimate, so revealing, ending up in the hands of the United States government?
Well, I think they were very small. I think when they made this tape, they had no idea, A, how we would respond, and B, how effective our response would be, because I think that they too often mischaracterize the United States. It's incredible how often our enemies think we won't fight. Even Saddam did not think, you know, we would send all those ground troops to chase them out of Kuwait. And nor did they realize how effective we become. I mean, people forget that in the 10 years since the Gulf War, we've improved the lethality of our, particularly our bombs, by a tenfold factor. So I think they really miscalculated in that understanding, and I think they also miscalculated how deep their support was in Afghanistan.
We're talking about the tapes that have been released today by the Pentagon of Osama bin Laden and his crew. Looking back, savoring what happened on September 11th, very specific, very explicit, kind of astonishingly so. What questions do these tapes raise for you? What issues do they settle for you? And does the tape change your view of how the U.S. should deal with Osama bin Laden? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Fashion is on the line. Hi, Fashion. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Hi. My question for your guests, and I guess it's the same question that you've posed to the callers, and that is, I'm just a little concerned, I mean, about the authenticity of the tapes. The dialogue to me seems a bit, I don't know, too exactly what we would be looking for as an American audience. And so that's...
So are you suggesting that they could have been phonied up somehow, created on a computer?
Yeah,
is that your fear?
Well, I don't know how one would do such a thing, and I mean, I realize how that sounds so sort of, you know, conspiracy theory-ish, but that was my first reaction.
Well, that's interesting. Fashion, thanks for your call. Lawrence Korb, what about it? Here's an American caller raising this question. Of course, there's been skepticism about the entire presentation of 9/11 in the Middle East. And today, I'm just looking here at the wires, Abdul Latif Arabiat, head of Jordan's mainstream Islamist party, said, do the Americans really think that the world is that stupid to think that they would believe that the tape is evidence? It looks real. It sounds real. Do you have any questions, Lawrence Korb, about its authenticity?
No, I don't, because at this point in time, we basically accomplished our mission in Afghanistan. We built the coalition that got support from countries like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Egypt to accomplish our objective. If this had come out, you know, on September 12th, one might have, you know, could question the motives, but really this doesn't add anything to where we already are now.
And it doesn't add anything in terms of, it certainly adds something in terms of evidence.
Well, it does, and there's no doubt about that. It does bolster our case, but it's really not something that we need at this present time, because they got the support of the American people. Mm-hmm. They got the support of the rest of the world, including countries like Russia and China. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, if you said, well, gee, we got to doctor something to get support, you if you were going to do that, you would have done it much earlier.
Of course, it's that last margin, and it's the big one, of the Islamic world that people are concerned with. You might have heard Senator Biden at the top of our hour saying that he thought this would be the persuasive evidence that the Muslim world needed, at least the mainstream, to be persuaded that bin Laden was in fact behind the terrorist attacks. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, very definitely. I think that there are people, I think I even mentioned under my comments, that in the Muslim world who doubted, you know, why we were going after bin Laden and couldn't comprehend that he would do something like this. So, yes, I think it does help us. But, I mean, if you were going to doctor it or come up with something that was inauthentic, you would have done it much earlier. That's the point I'm making in response to the caller's comment.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the tape says about how the United States should or will ultimately deal with Osama bin Laden when and if he's captured?
Well, I think it shows that certainly that he is somebody that needs to have the harshest penalty that can be exacted on someone who's captured. That in fact this was not a mistake or a mission gone wrong. In other words, he has really no defense for what he did.
Lawrence Korb, stand by. Let's take another call. We're talking about the Osama bin Laden tapes released today. Jovial. Men sitting around rocking on satisfaction, savoring their good fortune. How did it look to you? Does the tape change your view of how the United States should deal with Osama bin Laden? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Rob is on the line. Welcome, Rob. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Mr. Korb, I'm puzzled, without questioning the authenticity of the tape, I'm puzzled by bin Laden's point behind having it made at all. If he intended for it to be seen, who did he intend to see it? And if he didn't intend to be seen, why did he allow it to be taken? The mafia doesn't allow themselves to be videotaped when they're in meetings.
Yeah, I guess it's a terrific question. My guess, and it's only a guess because I don't know, is he never thought that we would win this war, and I think he may have wanted to use it as a recruiting tape for the next operation by saying, see, you know, we knew this was going on. I mean, it's what the Greeks would call hubris, this sense of invincibility. That's the only thing I can think of, because remember, this is best we know, this was found when the United States actually took over one of the cities, my guess, in Kandahar, which was the home of the Taliban, and I don't think they ever thought that the United States would be able to get in there or get in there that quickly.
Lawrence Korb, Rob, stand by. I want to bring another guest in now to help us address exactly this question. Gerald Post is professor of psychiatry and political psychology and international affairs at George Washington University. He spent a long career with the U.S. government. He founded the Center for the Analysis of Personality and Political Behavior, which helped, characterize foreign leaders who would be coming to the U.S. For summit meetings. He played a lead role in developing Camp David profiles of Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat for President Jimmy Carter. Good evening, Dr. Gerald Post.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. You've looked closely at the psychology of leaders, and you've looked at the psychology of politically motivated folks like Osama bin Laden. When you look at this tape, first to Rob's question, why do you think it was made? He clearly was happy having it made.
Well, I think this was a celebratory tape, perhaps to be recorded in the archives of Islamic triumphs, and was for an internal audience rather than unlike the other tapes which were released, which were for an external audience.
You've spent many years looking at the profiles of leaders internationally. When you look at Osama bin Laden in the formal tapes we've seen released earlier and then in this more intimate tape today, what do you see?
Well, this tape does shed a slightly different light publicly than the earlier ones. I'm particularly struck by his both the euphoria over the triumph and his rather callous disregard for human life. Not only the victims in the dreadful events of September 11th, but also his own people. How he's really a people user. And if I were a lower level member of Al Qaeda, I'd be rather troubled by the fact that those who went to their deaths on the plane, many of them didn't know what they were doing. Those who were leaders like Atta and others, to prepare yourself for martyrdom, you have a ritual bath the night before, there's a series of prayers to go through. These people didn't have a chance to do that. And he was laughing as he talked about this. It's really it gives a feeling of a kind of sadistic psychopath almost.
Well, Gerald Post, there's this strange combination of cool. He's very relaxed and at ease in his conversation and gestures, and even cool about death, as you say, juxtaposed with the intense passion buried in there somewhere, because after all, he's directing mass death. What is that personality profile?
Well, my label is malignant narcissism. And what that is represents someone who is sane, but the most dangerous kind of personality. It's got four components. One, such extreme messianic self-absorption and grandiosity. There's no ability to empathize with the pain or suffering of others. A paranoid attitude. Whatever happens is their fault, and I'm just, I have to defend myself against them. Psychopathic qualities in terms of little or no conscience, and finally using whatever aggression you can muster to carry out your own needs without any qualms of conscience. It's a very dangerous person. By the way, this is the same personality type of Saddam Hussein as well as Adolf Hitler.
Ooh, that's quite some company. Lawrence Korb, you've worked intimately with very, very high-ranking leaders. You're no stranger to self-absorption and even grandiosity in politicians, I'm sure. But what do you see in Osama bin Laden in that profile aspect?
Well, I think Dr. Post has got it right. I mean, that's a wonderful term, malignant narcissism. There's no doubt about the fact that he feels that he's on a mission, much like a Hitler, for example, and that the end justifies whatever means that he uses, whether it's sending his own people to death before they can prepare themselves for it, and not being concerned about human life. I mean, in fact, there's some words in the tape where they talk about the fact that, well, these people deserve to die. I mean, they didn't have any right to live anyway because they're not true believers. And
the visiting sheikh says Allah will forgive the believers. He's knowledgeable about everything.
Right, and it's the number of times in the dialogue between the sheikh and Osama bin Laden that they keep thanking Allah or God for this, that somehow or another that any type of God would look fondly on something like that is very, very difficult to comprehend.
I guess
on that point,
let me add
one other note. And I've talked to a moderate a Muslim cleric on this. In that jihad against the Jews and the Crusaders that he drafted, where it says all observant Muslims should follow God's command to kill all Americans, civilian and military, it's as if he is the new prophet, and he's got a pipeline to Allah. And I think one of the things that's happened, and going back to he only calculated those four floors would be taken out, and in fact it was the whole buildings, this confirms for him that Allah is on their side, the rectitude of his mission, and for his true believers, and I think when Mr. Korb was using that term, he's exactly right. This is the relationship between true believers and a destructive charismatic leader, and what the leader frames as their obligation, their duty, they uncritically accept because they've come to be in a state of awe for him. And each one of this cascading spiral of victories, going back to getting the Soviets out of Afghanistan through the First World Trade Center, Khobar Towers, the embassy bombings, the coal, and then this greatest spectacle of all times, surely this could not have been accomplished in his view and that of his followers unless Allah was on their side.
Allah is surely all through it, though there's a cultural element there as well. Let's get another quick call before the break. Kathleen is on the line. Welcome, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to comment on several things. I'm a psychiatric nurse. I'm also an interfaith minister.
Mm-hmm.
And the term that my sister and I used for Osama bin Laden as soon as we saw him was the trust fund terrorist.
Because he's so well-groomed?
No, because he's from a lot of money.
He sure is.
He's a man that had a background as a playboy who, in the article that was in the New York Times by Andrew Sullivan, that this is a religious war, I think it's very significant psychologically that this man is fighting an internal jihad by projecting it on to the United States as a corrupt, decadent society.
But what's the trust fund part? Yes, he was a playboy in Beirut in the early years. What else did you see?
Well, he also has all that family money behind him.
How does that express itself?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, I'd love to.
As a psychiatrist, you say something really quite important. And let's go not projecting onto the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Who does he take off on when he gets expelled? He starts talking about the heresy of the Saudi royal family, which, after all, is responsible for the fortune of the bin Laden family.
They gave his dad a monopoly.
Right, at which point he is expelled from Saudi Arabia, and his family attempts to turn their back. So he is biting the hand that fed the family fortune. You can almost look at this as sibling rivalry run amok, but I think there are some very powerful family dynamics. He was the only child of the least favored wife of Mohammed bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden has managed to climb into prominence. Gerald Post, Lawrence Korb, please stick with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the bin Laden tapes that came out today, the tape. Have you seen it? What does it make you feel about bin Laden, about justice, about where everything's going? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Osama bin Laden tape that came out today. What questions does it raise to you? What issues does it settle? We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join us. We are joined by Gerald Post, professor of psychiatry and political psychology at George Washington University, and by Lawrence Korb. He's the former assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration and now director of studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lawrence Korb, looking at this, it's interesting. They say the tape came from early November. The guys still look pretty cool, though even then the war was not going so well for them in Afghanistan. What do you make of that?
Well, again, I think he did not believe that, you know, Allah would let the United States win. And it's hard to tell how early it was, because in the first couple of weeks of the war, it didn't look like, you know, the Northern Alliance was going to do very well. Mm-hmm. And people were talking about how tenacious the Taliban was. So at that point, he may have, you know, believed his own press clippings. And I think a lot of us were surprised how quickly they did fall once the tide turned. So that's the only thing I can assume, and he may have assumed, well, maybe they'll capture Mazar-e-Sharif, but certainly never Kandahar.
Not the stronghold of the Taliban.
Right.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Robin is on the line. Welcome, Robin.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question. I've heard almost every commentator this evening on
yes.
your program and before that speaking of bin Laden, mentioning the fact with some glee that the people who participated in the attack on September the 11th, some of them did not know that it was a suicide mission. They did not know what they were getting into.
That appears to be what the tape suggests.
Well, I have heard one excerpt from the tape, and I've heard it twice, which is... And I don't say this to defend bin Laden in any degree,
mm-hmm.
which seems a little discrepant from that.
In what respect, Robin?
He said, I heard in the, and this is the translation and the transcript, that they were told that it was a martyrdom mission, but that they were not all told the nature of it until just before they got on the plane. But I distinctly heard the phrase that they were told that it was a martyrdom mission.
Yes, I think it's an important distinction. He's not saying that they didn't know that death might be involved. He said the brothers who conducted the operation, all they knew was they have a martyrdom operation. We
yes.
asked them to go to America, but they didn't know anything about the operation, not even one letter.
Mm-hmm.
So your point's well taken. It wasn't as though they thought this was going to be a walk in the park. Gerald Post, do you agree?
Yes, but my but is that for those actually going on martyrdom missions, and I think of the bombers in Israel, some of the seniors in the group who knew what they were doing, an important part of that is to be able to prepare yourself spiritually. And they were deprived of that opportunity. And he mm-hmm. seemed rather blithe about it in the way he discussed it.
He did. Lawrence Korb, I wondered, of course, we don't have access to the full understanding of what's shared here. Is it possible that his almost glee about that was in his mind a celebration of their martyrdom? There's so much embrace of suicide and death in this cult around bin Laden.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that these people knew that eventually they might, you know, have to be martyrs and give themselves up for the cause, but they didn't know it on that particular mission. And I think that's, you know, where Robin is looking at one part of the text and not putting it into context. But yes, I mean, because he's very happy that they did that, because he believes once they do that, then they'll, you know, go right up to heaven and enjoy all the wonderful things that the Quran promises.
One other point to add, the fact that he states, and this is for internal consumption, that they knew they were not going to be on a martyrdom mission, I don't mean to suggest that he might not be fully trustworthy, but in terms of need to know, mm-hmm. in fact, I think it's quite conceivable they didn't know they were on a martyrdom mission. As I understood it, these were late recruits who were sent over within months of the event to provide the muscle to subdue any passengers on the planes who might attempt to resist. And I think it's quite conceivable. In fact, they weren't told that it was a martyrdom mission.
We've just got a minute left. I want to ask each of you. I've seen this tape running in its full length on Al Jazeera, the Arab region satellite television network. And as it plays there, I wonder if even for all the horror of the words, this might still not be something of a recruiting tape in that region. He looks bold, he looks cool, and he's romantic, even talking about mass death. Lawrence Korb?
Well, it's no doubt about the fact that he's kind of the Robin Hood of that part of the world, and there will be obviously some people who will say, you know, even with the American victory, now more than ever we need, to join up with bin Laden. And the fact that he hasn't been captured yet sort of adds a certain amount of aura to him.
Hmm. And Gerald Post, we just have 20 seconds, but your thought there?
I agree. True believers will continue to believe is a hero to many. It's the ambivalent middle that I think will hear this and perhaps back away, hopefully.
Mm. Gerald Post, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
A great pleasure.
And Lawrence Korb, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Korb is Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Gerald Post is Professor of Psychiatry and Political Psychology at George Washington University. You can read a transcript of the Osama bin Laden tape by going to our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Tonight, we continue our series with the Project for Muslim Understanding. Six Muslim academics from across the country have come together since the terrorist attacks on America to analyze global trends which contributed to the events of September 11th. Joining us now is Zahra Saif Amir Hosseini, a British scholar who recently received her PhD in Sociology and International Relations from the London School of Economics and currently teaches in the Sociology Department at Georgetown University. Her paper is entitled A Clash of Civilizations. Welcome, Zahra Saif Amir Hosseini.
Thank you.
As far back as 1989, Samuel Huntington was writing about this clash of civilizations, and the events of this fall have seemed to many people to be the coming to pass, finally, of this clash. You disagree. Why?
I would like to start off by looking at Huntington's definition of civilization, and I would like to split it into two parts, part one being where Huntington has got it right, and part two being where Huntington has got it completely wrong.
So where does he have it right?
He has it right in that he gives civilization a religious basis, and most civilizations have some kind of religious roots. Mm-hmm. So insofar as that, he has got it right. But what he fails to tease out later in his argument is that what he comes to identify as religion are, in fact, politically motivated movements of the 20th century, in particular in relation to Islam.
Well, but here's where I wonder if your definition may not be more purist than most people's. You say he's got it wrong because what he's looking at is a politicized Islam of the 20th century. But so what? That's the Islam that we're dealing with.
Yes. But I think it would be completely wrong to represent a faith of so many millions of people as a political version which is believed in and practiced by a very small minority, and usually for political purposes rather than having any doctrinal basis or spiritual value.
So you're saying that this is not a clash of civilizations, this is a clash between the West and an extremist group of terrorists?
More or less, but I think there are so many complexities in that. I mean, the concept of political Islam is actually a 20th century phenomenon. It was started by people like al-Afghani, who tried to bring some kinds of concept of modernization within the Middle East. And the way in which they tried to do this was by using Islamic language and symbolism, because the population by large is very religious, and it was recognized very early on by these modernists or Islamic political modernists that the one way of motivating the masses would be through Islamic symbolism.
But why doesn't that in toto make up the civilization, in fact, that the West is now confronting?
Right. Why it doesn't make up the civilization is, in fact, the West in a way has a hand in this rise of political Islam,
mm-hmm.
because both Britain and the United States were actually pursuing a very active policy of funding Islamic fundamentalist groups, for want of a better name, or kind of political Islamists, as a way of combating communism and pan-Arab nationalism, and as a sure way of ensuring that communist ideology wouldn't spread through that region of the world.
Right, and there's no point in walking away or ignoring that. At the same time, we're trying to figure out how to move forward. Through this lens of civilization, a couple of common perceptions out of the last few months. One, that the bookend to Samuel Huntington was Francis Fukuyama talking about the end of history, by which he meant free markets and liberal democracy were more or less destined to succeed globally. And now we see Islam first as appearing to be in opposition to modernization. Do you agree?
I mean, of course, Fukuyama and Huntington are always set up as being the opposite end of this spectrum. Like,
okay,
if Fukuyama's theory is proven wrong because Huntington's theory of clash of civilization has been proven to be right.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, they're both coming very much from the same premise of cultural essentialism. And they both view Islam as providing obstacles to modernization and development. And this comes from a kind of misinterpreted notion of the fact that Islam is a religion that encompasses politics and religion in one unity. Whereas if you look at it historically, this has never been the case. It's always been states that have tried to forge a religious ideology onto their politics. And this is what I mean, the notion of political Islam is very important in interpreting not only the recent events, but the whole history of the Islamic civilization.
But if you take it out of the academic realm, where we look at Islam in some disembodied way, and look at the Islamic world, mm-hmm. it does seem to be showing signs of real antagonism toward modernization.
I wouldn't say modernization, because I mean, I think it would be very wrong to assume that there is only one pattern of modernization, and if countries are to develop and become fully participating nations and democracies, that they necessarily have to follow the Western pattern. And I think what the Islamic world is trying to do is trying to find its own way of modernizing or developing and dealing with the whole new international dynamics.
The other fork of this kind of Francis Fukuyama picture seems to be the inevitability of secularism, and Islam, by everyone's interpretation, seems in opposition to that. It seems to insist that secularism will not be dominant in the Islamic world, does it not?
If we look at the concept of secularism within the West, the whole notion of secularism comes from very much a religious premise, because everyone started off at looking at the world in religious terms. And the only way secularism plays into this is where no longer this is happening and people are kind of defining themselves as in opposition to secularism. But then secularism, I think, has both positive and negative effects. The kind of secularism that people argue for in terms of tolerance of the various mm-hmm. religious interpretations and various bold views, and this is what the secularists really argue for, that the whole point behind secularism is that it allows pluralism.
This clash of civilizations model seems to resonate so much right now. Samuel Huntington's book is back at the top of bestseller lists around the world.
Yes.
I just saw, including in Germany.
Yes.
The West has been assuming that it's on a track that will lead to a world that is focused on free markets, liberal democracy, and secular society. Isn't Islam opposed to a good deal of that?
What the thesis overlooks mostly is the civilizational exchange between the Muslim world and the Western world. And that fundamentally, if you think of in terms of philosophy, medicine, astrology, mathematics, there is a lot of common basis. Basically, all this knowledge was transmitted back to Western Europe, from the Greeks through the Muslims.
So how do we pull out of this apparent collision?
I think the way forward is by identifying Islam and political Islam as being two very fundamentally differing spheres.
And once that's done in the West, how is that translated into the Islamic world itself?
This has been a great point of discussion. How do we get dialogue going? And I think one way would be for Western powers to seriously rethink their foreign policy in terms of the whole Muslim region. And as ways of trying to show goodwill would be one way of promoting a lot of non-governmental organizations working in those parts of the world that are trying to bring about reform. I mean, I'm talking about kind of non-militant groups that are working on grassroots basis throughout the Muslim world, trying to bring about peaceful means of change in their society, from culture to education to political participation to pluralism.
It sounds like a tall order and a long-term project, but we're glad for the nuance that you give us in understanding a possible way forward. Zahra Saif Amir Hosseini, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Zahra Saif Amir Hosseini is a British scholar who recently received her PhD in sociology and international relations from the London School of Economics. She's currently teaching in the sociology department at Georgetown University. Her paper is entitled A Clash of Civilizations. Tomorrow we talk with another Muslim PhD candidate about his paper, The Economics of Terrorism, How Worldview Can Alter the Rules of the Game. Listeners, for a future show, we want to know about the music you've turned to since the events of September 11th, for strength, for hope, or to grieve. You can email your selections to special@wbur.org or call 617-358-0056. Let us know what you've been listening to and why you've embraced it. Make sure to include your email address. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.